Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of For the Record program number 783. Can you put lipstick on the Nazi? This has been recorded on March 23rd of the year 2014. We are once again going to be covering extending our ongoing coverage of the crisis in the Ukraine. And already there are 6 programs that are in the can, so to speak. So I can only encourage listeners who are new to this to go to the SpitfireList.com website, read the descriptions, and follow the archived audio files to get yourselves up to speed. Now, much of this broadcast is going to consist of the reading of a very important article that appeared in the Op-Ed News. It was written by a fellow named George Eliason, or Eliason, I don't know how it's pronounced, capital E-L-I-A-S-O-N. A fair amount of the history of the OUNB, that is a Ukrainian fascist organization that was aligned with the Third Reich, jumped to Western intelligence, including the CIA, MI6, and in particular the BND, and ultimately was reinstalled in the Ukraine, albeit with a second generation, when the Svoboda and the Pravi sector interests came to power as a result of the coup d'etat against former President Yanukovych. Again, Yanukovych was both incompetent and corrupt by all accounts. He was, however, democratically elected and was really no more incompetent or corrupt than any of his predecessors, who basically stunk, to make a long story short. Also, as far as incompetence and corruption goes, Mr. Yanukovych had an awful lot of company among world leaders, including quite a few that have held sway in the U.S. What Mr. Eliason here is calling attention to, in addition to the true nature of what is going on in the Ukraine, is the fact that the West is being portrayed as democratic, and somehow Svoboda and Pravi sector and the OUNB Redux government in the Ukraine is being portrayed as somehow democratic, or democratic because it is allied with the West. In this program, and in particular next week, we're going to take a look at the remaking of this particular political phalanx and the stunning attempts at representing what is overtly fascist and Nazi and extremist with a capital E into somehow tolerable. And one of the things that he notes is that the West has basically switched sides. We are promoting fascism in the Ukraine, and warts and all, and there are no shortage of warts on President Putin, that he and the Russians are the only force that basically is opposing the horrendous things that are going on in the Ukraine. I also suspect, and we'll develop this perhaps in future programs, although we also have an awful lot of other things to cover, I suspect that Putin was lured into a trap. I think he was meant to do exactly this. I don't think that there is a world leader anywhere that would not do what Putin did, given what he was faced with, which was not only blocking the Russian access to the Black Sea and doing huge damage to the Russian economy by flooding it with goods from EU and Germany, but also the overtly fascist and World War II Nazi revanchist nature of the current government and their strident anti-Russian activities and point of view. In this program, in this article, in this program, we're going to highlight, among other things, the indoctrination of Ukrainian schoolchildren who had Russian names with an anti-Russian ideology and the browbeating of those children to feel ashamed of their Russian names and to change their Russian names to a Ukrainian conjugation. We're going to take a look at the fact that the current government in the Ukraine is basically an extension of the National Socialist or Nazi government of the Ukraine under Stefan Bandera, that went into exile, was nurtured within the bowels of Western intelligence, and in particular the Republican Party and the German political establishment as well. And then it was recast, so to speak, or projected into the Ukraine. Key names here. Stefan Bandera, of course, was the head of the OUNB. We've talked about that in the past. His primary deputy was a guy named Yaroslav Stetsko, and he was the fellow who was the head of the OUNB in exile until his death in 1996. Then his widow, Slava Stetsko, took over that position, and Slava Stetsko had among her proteges not only Viktor Yushchenko, but also Yulia Tymoshenko, and we're going to take a look as well at Arseniy Yatsenyuk's affiliation with this very same milieu. Part of the attempt to put lipstick on the Nazi, oh, by the way, that is a reference to a well-known saying, if you put lipstick on a pig, at the end of the day, it's still a pig. And what the Western media are doing with editorial slant and overt censorship, the Svoboda OUNB Nazi heirs are doing with violence, as we will see. There is a huge attempt at putting lipstick on the Ukrainian Nazi pig, and one of the things that is being done is to assure various people that they have nothing to fear. There was a meeting with the Israeli ambassador to the Ukraine at which the Israeli ambassador was assured that there will be no anti-Semitism in the upcoming regime in the Ukraine. Recall that in For the Record 780, we took a look at an Israeli agency's efforts at training Ukrainian Jews, not only in self-defense, but in how to act when you are being mobbed by an anti-Semitic mob. It would not surprise me, if it was certainly rhetorically because of Israel's dependence on the United States, Israel is going to toe the line publicly about what a bunch of great guys are holding forth in the Ukraine. I would note that the government, as we looked at most recently in For the Record 776, the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, in many ways, is the heir to the fascist element within the Zionist movement. Not that the Zionist movement is fascist in and of itself, but it has always had a fascist component, and Netanyahu is heir to that, and Netanyahu and his Likud party, as well as other ministers in the current government, have been networking actively with various Euro-fascists, to coin a term. So it may be that the Israeli ambassador's meeting with these creatures will fall into that category. I would note, and one of the things we are going to note here, that when the some 500,000 Poles, Jews, and others who were slaughtered by the OUNB's Nazi and SS units, before they were killed, they received explicit assurances of safety and sanctity and protection from their very future executioners. We're going to be looking at that, and I think that the assurances that are coming out of the current government of the Ukraine have to be seen against that background. Also, I would note that in editorials in the New York Times and elsewhere, the Russian contention that the current government of the Ukraine is composed of neo-Nazis and Russophobes is viewed as extreme and simply propaganda. It certainly is not extreme, nor is it propaganda. One of the things that we are going to examine in this story are overt statements by people like Dmytro Yarosh, Pravi Sektor, that Ukrainian lands, unquote, are going to be liberated, including a lot of, quote, Ukrainian lands that are in Russia. We are not hearing much about this, but again, as we are hearing about Russian thugs in parts of the eastern Ukraine, which are have a long historical affinity with Russia, and as the notion of Russophobia is being dismissed along with the notion of, quote, neo-Nazis, unquote, in the Ukraine. Ask yourselves, in addition to the fossil fuel considerations, and we are going to examine that later on in the broadcast, ask yourselves how many countries would sit idly by when an historical force which had been involved in killing millions of its own citizens and was simply recapitulating that same political agenda and ideology and making overt statements about seizing parts of Russia, how would any world leader be expected to react? Okay? That is part of the agenda. We are also going to be looking more again at the fact that 25% of the world's proven natural gas reserves are in the Ukraine. And we're also going to examine how Russia's reabsorption of the Crimea changes that game. As you listen to the Orwellian squawking and propagandizing about what is going on there, never lose sight of the long history of installing fascist regimes in the Third World when transnational and, in particular, U.S.-based transnational corporations' interests are seen as being at threat, whether or not they actually were. We have not hesitated to install murderous fascist dictators in Latin America, Asia, and elsewhere when corporate interests were at stake. This is not really all that different from what is taking place in the Ukraine. And again, I think that natural gas, fossil fuels, and big bucks or big euros has a whole lot more to do with this than anything having to do with, quote, democracy, unquote, because democracy has nothing to do with the forces that the West is backing in the Ukraine. And we're also going to examine later on the fact that both the German NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, and German NGOs, including elements associated with Angela Merkel's CDU party, have actively backed and networked with the Svoboda OUNB heirs in the Ukraine. Most of our broadcast is going to take place, or an awful lot of it, of the reading of a very, very important article, again, by George Eliason, or Eliason, E-L-I-A-S-O-N as in Nancy, from the Op-Ed News of March 16th of 2014. This article is titled, "The Nazis Even Hitler Was Afraid Of," unquote. I'm going to read the entire article into the record. EU politicians that supported the Maidan revolution are voicing concerns bordering on fear about how much control ultranationalists have over the government in Kiev. Chancellor Merkel's government is telling her she can no longer afford to ignore the ultranationalists in the Ukraine. They are scared that Germany will be responsible for setting up a new Reich. Parenthetically, this is Mr. Eliason's view. I don't think they're scared at all. I think that is just exactly what they had in mind. Continuing, it's time to strip away the rest of the veneer and take a look at what is really there. Forget about the Nazi symbolism and ultranationalist exuberance. I will even grant the supporters of the current government that much. Every important ministry, from education and social policy to policing, prosecution, and national defense, is headed by ultranationalists. Parenthetically, even Mr. Eliason gets sucked into what I think is a linguistic quicksand. If Hitler came back today, materialized in the middle of Times Square, coverage of this would refer to him as an ultranationalist. If Heinrich Himmler materialized in the middle of the Capitol, middle of the floor of the U.S. Senate, dressed in a Waffen-SS camouflage uniform, bucket helmet with a smoking submachine gun, covered with blood, and 300 or 400 freshly murdered victims at his feet. He would be referred to as an ultra-nationalist or a paleoconservative. Part of the way the Ministry of Truth is operating is to make the word fascist or Nazi simply not part of the newspeak lexicon. And although I think this is an excellent article, and Mr. Eliason deserves tremendous credit for writing it, he too gets seduced by referring to Nazis and fascists as ultra-nationalists. I'm going to remain true to his text, but the audience, when you hear ultra-nationalist, substitute fascist or Nazi. Beginning again with this last couple of sentences. Every important ministry in the Ukraine, from education and social policy to policing, prosecution, and national defense, is headed by ultra-nationalists. In every aspect of national life, ultra-nationalists now determine what it means to be Ukrainian and all the policies needed to enforce it. Even Prime Minister Yatsenyuk falls among this majority. For generations, his own family has had a proud tradition of service to the ultra-nationalist cause and has won awards for service to it. Before Maidan hurt his chances for election, after Maidan, he didn't need to worry about election. Before Maidan, it hurt his chances for election. After Maidan, he didn't need to worry about election. In an op-ed piece in the L.A. Times entitled Ukraine's Threat from Within, director of the School of International Relations at USC, Robert English, very concisely warns that, quote, the way Ukrainian ultranationalists whitewash Bandera history, which is their past, makes the present and future all that much more scary. The Banderas or Banderites are activists in the Ukrainian ultranationalist movement that is now in control of the government in the Ukraine. Under the militant leadership of Stefan Bandera in World War II, the ultranationalists organized the Ukrainian Waffen-SS Galician, Nichtengal, and Roland divisions that collaborated with the Nazis and were responsible for the genocide of over 500,000 people. Following the war, however, Ukrainian Nazis were the only group to escape trial at Nuremberg for crimes against humanity. Moreover, neither the Banderas, the Ukrainian Waffen-SS, nor any other Ukrainian collaborators have ever apologized for their participation in genocide. In the landmark work on the subject, Genocide Committed by Ukrainian Nationalists on the Polish Population During World War II, Ryszard Zawoski, S-Z-A-W-L-O-W-S-K-I, characterizes it this way. Quote, the Germans have long admitted to their crimes and have apologized for them publicly. The President of the Federal Republic of Germany, Roman Herzog, said in his speech in Warsaw on August 1, 1994, quote, I bow before the fighters of the Warsaw Uprising and before all the Polish war victims. I beg forgiveness for what the Germans did. Russian President Boris Yeltsin, when he kissed Monsignor Zdzisław Peskowski on the hand, whispered the words, I apologize. Ukrainian genocide committed against the Poles during World War II surpassed German and Soviet aggression. It was marked by the utmost ruthlessness and barbarity, and up until the present day it has been denied or at best presented with reminders that all is, quote, relative, unquote, or other such evasions, unquote. As we saw in For the Record 781, it has actually been stood on its head, and the OUNBR have been portrayed in OUNB propaganda as defenders of the Jews against the Holocaust. Continuing. According to Zawoski's description of the methods the Banderites employed against the Poles at Volhynia, treachery was the most frequently used. The Banderites told the Poles that they were one people and one family with them, and that it would be treason if they left. The Bandera groups even promised to protect them in writing. What else separates the Banderas from every other genocidal perpetrator of the war is this. Even though the German SS had units dedicated to genocide, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, approached this mission with a zeal and barbarity that Hitler's own units could not muster. They routinely tortured people with saws and axes and used the most painful methods they could devise as means to kill them. Parenthetically, the Croatian Ustashi did the same thing. They, too, were in many ways returned right back to power during the breakup of Yugoslavia and the subsequent civil wars. Continuing, the Bandera would attack using, quote, self-defense groups that were locally organized. These civilian Banderas were the main force used to attack and slaughter the Poles. If any of the massacre victims managed to survive, they were robbed and killed, often by burning them alive by follow-up groups of women and children. Zelovsky's work on the genocide committed by Ukrainian nationalists during World War II is brought up to date by the recent observations of Ukrainian Viktor Polishuk. Quote, he condemns the dangerous activities of the post-UPA or Ukrainian Insurgent Army nationalists in present-day Ukraine, taking place not only in Lvov, but even in Kiev. Galician fundamentalism and other such phenomena, that a reference to the 14th Waffen-SS or Galician Division. Continuing, also criticized by him are the promoting of the totalitarian and genocidal doctrines of the Ukrainian Dmytro Donsov, the erecting of monuments to the SS men of the 14th Ukrainian SS Division or Galician, the OUN and UPA leaders Yevhen Konovalets, Andrei Melnik, Stefan Bandera, Roman Shukievich, and others, and the glorifying of the murderers of Poles, Jews, Russians, and Ukrainians as national heroes of the Ukraine, after whom streets and squares are named, awakening the spirit of the Donsev and Bandera era, so much hated by people. This was written only a few years ago. Every major scholarly work, a prime example are the papers of Per-Anders Rudling, show that the Banderas murdered 500,000 people without even the pretext of an apology. They have lied and tried to change history in an effort to make Stefan Bandera and the Waffen-SS heroes of the Great War. Among other tactics, they have tried to petition the UN to reclassify Bandera and take his name off the UN's list of leading Nazi collaborators and perpetrators of genocide. Legitimizing these men would irrevocably change the history of the Great War. According to the Huffington Post, quote, Dmitry Yarosh, leader of Right Sector, met with Israel's ambassador to the Ukraine, Reuven Dinael, and told him that their movement rejects anti-Semitism and xenophobia and will not tolerate it. Right Sector became famous at the beginning of the Euromaidan protests and subsequent revolution. It serves as the umbrella group for the combined militant ultra-nationalist groups that existed in the Ukraine prior to the revolution and that insist on a pure ultra-nationalist Ukrainian nation under the most rigid conformity to Stefan Bandera's philosophy. Mr. Yarosh is the leader of Trizhub, or Trident, which is the core Right Sector group. He has spent 20 years doing nothing else but preparing for the revolution that will sweep Ukraine's government into extreme ultranationalism. Despite his reassuring words to the Israeli ambassador, Dmitry Yarosh has been very clear from his first interviews that he is guided only by Bandera's writings and the writings of the group's founding leaders. He adheres to nothing else. Mr. Yarosh is adamant about the fact that Stefan Bandera was not an anti-Semite. Both the Anti-Defamation League and the State of Israel accept at face value that, given Yarosh's claim that Bandera was not an anti-Semite, a claim he himself believes, the Jewish community can now relax about any contemporary threat from Ukrainian nationalists. But can the State of Israel, or Abraham Foxman, chairman of the ADL, or anyone else sticking his fingers into this pie, explain away the deaths of over 200,000 Jews at the hands of the Banderites? No. The ADL describes its main purpose as fighting anti-Semitism and all forms of bigotry and defending democratic ideals. Counterposed to that, the entire history of the Ukrainian ultranationalist movement, including its history of today. When you do, can there be any assurances from its representatives that don't ring hollow? Next, Mr. Eliason goes on to talk about the famous Babi Yar massacre in the Ukraine. The thinking today is true to pre-World War II form. This can't happen again. Part of what is clouding the issue is the very Jewish backgrounds of some in the Kiev government, including Mr. Yatsenyuk. A few of the oligarchs turned governors even have Israeli citizenship. During World War II, Babi Yar was the single most horrific act of Holocaust at the time. Even today, the Banderite response to Babi Yar is, quote, "I am proud of the fact that among the 1,500 Pulitzer executioners in Babi Yar, there were 1,200 OUN men, but only 300 Germans," unquote. This quote is from a Rivne city official named Shkuratiuk, S-H-K-U-R-A-T-I-U-K, and appears in the book Organized Anti-Semitism in Contemporary Ukraine, Structure, Influence, and Ideology by the aforementioned Professor Pers Anders Rudling of the University of Lund in Sweden. The atrocities at Babi Yar and the accompanying brutality were left to the SS Nachtigal and the Polizei. Both were Banderite. The reason was simple. The brutal work of genocide at this level made even hardened German SS uncomfortable. This fact is even obscured in the Holocaust Encyclopedia at the United States Holocaust Museum. During the period of September 29th to 30th, 1941, the first massacre at Babi Yar killed over 30,000 Jews. Over the next few years, the genocide piled up. Victims from the Roma or Gypsies alone numbered almost 200,000. Banderite apologists have offered a range of rationalizations, from Ukrainians suffered too, to the surreal Bandera's men stepped back and let the Jews do it themselves, unquote. No kidding. Babi Yar was racial suicide. What separates Germany from the Bandera nationalists in the Ukraine is that Germany has taken responsibility for the atrocities that they committed. Until recent events, they could say believably, "Never again," unquote. Contrast this to the Lvov, Ukraine, where surviving members of the World War II Galician SS, willing participants in genocide, still parade on holidays, proudly displaying medals given them by the German Third Reich. We are going to continue with the story in Side 2. Again, all of the For the Record shows and my entire life's work is available on the SpitfireList.com website. And if some of the admittedly pedantic presentation is a bit much for people to absorb, the entire text of this article will be included in the article-length description for this program. I do such article-length descriptions for all of the For the Record programs. This concludes Side one For the Record program number 783. Can you put lipstick on a Nazi? This is being recorded on March 23rd of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.